We'll start at just maybe a 30-second introduction. Rabbi Schaffner is the rabbi of Kesher Israel in Washington, D.C., the shul closest to the White House. I don't know if that's L'Shevach or L'Gnai. I shouldn't say that as a Canadian. And he served, I think, for close to 14 years in St. Louis as a rabbi.
Yeah, I was in St. Louis altogether for 20 years. I was at the Hillel at WashU for 8.
Right, Hillel, correct. He's a Hillel, then a rabbi, and he served for a rabbi in India for a That's year. Right. So it makes it interesting. And it's a pleasure to welcome him to Torah Motion for the first time and to have him participate in the shiur. Rabbi Schaffner, Rebecca Schatz, all yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here with all of you. We've been obviously been teaching a lot on Zoom these days, as all rabbis have. I've heard so many wonderful things about Torah Motion, and it's definitely prompted me to look at the website. And I'm like, wow, I got to register for a bunch of things because it's great stuff. So I'm really honored to be included among it. I'm going to share my screen with you. Let's see, here we go. Okay. Obviously this week is a double parsha. It's Achrimos Kedoshim. I'm going to focus my the class on the beginning of Kedoshim. Now, obviously, you know, as we all know, Kedoshim means holy, and it begins with God commanding Moshe to tell the Jewish people, "Darbel b'nei Yisrael, v'armatolim Kedoshim tiyu ki Kedoshim nishim l'kechem." You should be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. And many of us probably know that Rashi, which you can see right here. Rashi comments on that. First, he says that this was spoken at Hakel. Probably the Book of Devarim was spoken at Hakel, but also some other parts. And this is one that he thinks was because Rov Gufei Torah Tuliyinba, because he thinks that most of the important things in the Torah are dependent either on this parsha, the beginning of this parsha, or maybe means on the concept of Kedusha. That's one possibility. And then he says, so obviously, what is Kedusha? So Rashi says, Purush min ha'arayos min ha'aveira. It means to separate yourself from illicit sexuality and from sin. And then he proves it. He seems to prove the first part of the statement. Wherever you find geder erva, wherever you find a fence around sexuality, forbidden sexuality, so there you find holiness. And he brings three proofs for that. But the word Kedusha is also around a fence, around a limitation for instance, a Kedesha or a Zona. But obviously it brings up the bigger question of asceticism in Judaism. Is asceticism, right? Rashi's saying here, not only should you, it's interesting, it seems redundant, right? He says, he could have just said, Prushimin ha'aveira. If he wants you to keep the Torah, to say, don't sin. That would include arayot. That would include forbidden sexual immorality. And if this isn't about keeping the Torah, if this is about something in particular about sexuality that fences around that, which he seems to be saying in second Rashi, create Kedusha, so why not just focus on that? We're gonna go in the direction a little bit of looking at the question of asceticism in Judaism, and I think it's a vital question. There's certain things that are questions that loom so large, questions of are we an ascetic religion or not? It's not all that clear. How do we view non-Jews? How do we view the world? All these questions are fundamental. And like all the great questions that are really fundamental, they don't have very clear answers. And so we'll see that the Mefarshim are all over, and the Ramban very famously, there's a Gemara. A Gemara says, "Amarava kadosh atzim chaba mutulach." There's a concept in the Gemara of kedusha, that you should sanctify yourself by limiting yourself even in that which is permitted to you. Which may be a step perhaps beyond Rashi. Right? Rashi seems to be saying that he wants you just to stay away from that which is forbidden, especially in the realm of sexuality. Is that the same or different than Mekadesh Atmecha B'Matalech? Is that different than saying, there are things that are permitted to me, but maybe I should limit those also? The Ramban very famously draws on this concept. And I wonder if my screen is big enough so that you can see the Hebrew and English. Tell you what, I'm going to put the English. Well, I'm going to do the Hebrew and I'm going to translate. And as I go down, hopefully it will eliminate. Okay. Kedoshim to you. So the Ramban very famously says, have a prushim in a rice min aveir. Shkol mokum shatamotze geder erva atamotze kedusha. So Lashon Rashi quotes Rashi that stay away from sin and from sexual immorality, because wherever you have a boundary against sexual immorality, there you have holiness. He says, "Al b'taras kohanim reisi stam prushin to you." He says, if you look in the Midrash, we don't see Rashi's explanation. We see a general concept of prushin to you. You should be separate. You should be, it's hard to know exactly prushin means. Parush probably means separate. He says, va'inyan, here's how the Ramban explains it. He says the Torah forbids certain things and it permits certain things. It permits certain kinds of sexuality and forbids others. It permits certain things that you're allowed to eat and it forbids others. So in Cain, he says, but that gives us a dilemma. If the Torah, if Judaism has this kind of legal structure, and that's one of the most fundamental things about Judaism, that leaves us with a dilemma, says the Ramban. And that is that if things are permitted to us, we might say, in fact, I think we often do find this, certain parts of even the Orthodox world, there's a kind of attitude that whatever's forbidden is forbidden, but everything else basically is permitted. Is that a proper attitude religiously? Really, these ideas of asceticism, which seem to be, beside the point for us, they seem to be sort of meta questions for or for Hasidim, in the old sense of the term, they really are very, very present. What should our everyday attitude be as, let's say, Jews, modern Orthodox Jews, to the world, to life, to mitzvot? Do I have to, it's something I've struggled a lot throughout my whole life trying to figure out. Basically, is everything permitted except that which is forbidden? Or, as they used to tell us in Yeshiva, maybe you have to have a deep cheshbon hanefesh for everything you do. Maybe everything, in a certain sense, is forbidden because your life should be spent engaged in holiness, engaged in Torah study, engaged in spirituality. And there's room for other things, but you have to have some kind of cheshbon in order to engage in those things. Which is it? I mean, we see both attitudes, I think, in the Orthodox community. The Ramban here says the dilemma is if we allow that which is permitted to us in the Torah and forbid that which is forbidden, Im kein yimatze bal taiva makom liyos shutuf bezimas ishto and o nashiv harabot. He says that if you permit certain kinds of sexuality, you permit it to your wife, well, maybe you have many wives. And then your life is going to be filled with your desire. Lios besove yayin, zole basar. You're allowed to drink wine. You're allowed to eat meat. But what does that mean? Does that mean that your life is going to be filled with drinking wine and eating meat? And he then says that you might even speak naval, shelo huzkar isu zeba Torah. He says speaking in a brutish way is not specified in the Torah. Maybe I'm allowed to do that. So he says, one of the most famous things in the Ramban, hineiya naval birshuta Torah. It would turn out that you are a minuval birshuta Torah, that with the permission of the Torah, the Ramban says, not enough to keep the mitzvahs, even to study Torah, that's not enough. With all of that, you could still be a disgusting person with the permission of the Torah if you just keep the letter of the law. So that's interesting. The Ramban is framing religious life in a certain way. What does it mean to be a Jew? For the Ramban, it doesn't mean to keep the Torah. There's some kind of meta requirement, some kind of meta ethical or meta legal ethic that we need to conform to in order to be who we are supposed to be. The law is not the sum total of Judaism. So we'll want to keep in mind, does this disagree with Rashi or not? The Ramban seems to think maybe it does disagree with Rashi, but we can keep that question in mind. Now the Ramban then continues, And he says, that's why the Torah tells us, Kedoshim tiyu ki kedoshim ne'eshem l'kechem. The question inherent in Ramban is, if we have all the mitzvahs, then isn't that what's going to make you holy? Why does the Torah have to say, by the way, be holy? Just keep the mitzvah between you and God, keep all the ritual mitzvah, and you'll be holy. So Ramban says that's not true. He does say this also on the phrase, Vasisa yashar v'atov b'nei Hashem. He says exactly the same idea about interpersonal commandments. That if you think that keeping all the interpersonal commandments is going to make you righteous, he says, or even just, he says, that's not true. The same thing can happen. You can be a menuval b'shus ha-Torah. You can find lots of ways to get around interpersonal things. And therefore, the Torah had to, after all the detailed laws, the Torah had to give you a general rule. Vasisa yashar v'atov b'nei Hashem. Do what is good and right in the eyes of God. It's not enough just to keep the b'nei Adam l'chaveiro mitzvot, the mitzvot between us and others. You have to also do what is yashar. And here, of course, kedoshim tiyu is exactly the equivalent, but in a b'nei Adam l'makom context. So he writes, Shalya Talmud Chacham, he writes a little bit more on the same theme. And then, interestingly, he compares it to the Nazir. And this part is a little bit complex, because he says, Kamoshkar Katuv HaNazir Kadosh. The Nazir is called holy. And he seems to be saying that our idea of holiness, that you shouldn't be a minuval birshut HaTorah. He's not saying you shouldn't necessarily be an ascetic. He's saying, be a mensch, and don't just, completely fill yourself with desire at the tip of a hat, just because it's permitted and it's not forbidden. It really is, that would not fit into the meta image of dignity, perhaps we could call it, or probably better words for it, a refinement. Now, the idea of bringing in the Nazir, and then that the Nazir is called holy, that sort of throws a monkey wrench in, because the Nazir is not somebody that we imagine to be just resisting the Ramban's, being a disgusting person with the permission of the Torah. The Nazir seems to be more of an ascetic. So is the Ramban conflating the two? Or are these different things? That's, I think, also a very important question. He ends with, Zer derech haTorah lefrat v'chlal. This is the way of the Torah, that it gives you details and then it gives you a general rule. And here he tells you about what I mentioned before. So I would ask the question of a few questions here. Is Mekadesh Atzmecha b'mutar lach? You can see the English also. Is sanctifying yourself in that which is permitted to you, that the Gemara had said? From the Gemara, it seems like you should be a bit more ascetic. You should resist even that which is permitted to you. Is that different or the same than being a minuval bershut, than not being a minuval bershut atarah? Is that different or the same than what the Ramban says, that you have to go beyond the letter of the law so that you are a refined individual, a holy individual, and you're not just taking advantage of everything the Torah permits you? Are those the same? Are those different? The Rashi and the Ramban disagree. Remember, Rashi had said, don't do sins, and also, Rashi had said, "Prushim in ha'arayot min aver," separate yourself from forbidden sexuality and from sin, because wherever you find a gate around forbidden sexuality, you find holiness. Is that different than the, as Ramban disagreeing with Rashi? Is he going beyond the letter of the law in this kind of ethical refinement of the Ramban's, not being a minuval b'shus Torah? And how do we understand the Ramban bring in the Nazir? Is the Ramban slipping in that he's pro-asceticism? Is his idea of not being a disgusting person, not just giving in to all of your desires, is that, that's not asceticism? It seems very different than the Nazir. Okay, by the way, if you have thoughts or questions, you should really feel free to, at any time, just to ask and to interrupt. Okay, so I want to delve a little bit more into this question of asceticism, because I think in many religions, asceticism is taken for granted, that would be a positive thing. Not that everybody can do it, right? In Christianity, it's okay to have a family, but if you really want to be on a high spiritual level, you don't do that. You separate yourself. Among Buddhists, you could be a Buddhist who works the ground, but you could also be a monk, and that's a higher level. I think we sort of slip into this in Judaism also. You have almost made a distinction, I think, between the working folk and, you know, what they call in more right-wing circles, the Ungelites, you know, the kolel. Are they, do we see them as on a higher level? Is that different than what it says in Pirkei Avot, that, you know, which seems to praise often the work of one's hands? What's the paradigm in Judaism? Or perhaps there's more than one paradigm. That may be actually the story about asceticism. So let's see, this is a famous Gemara. The Gemara says, Omar Shmuel said, Kala Yoshev Betanit Nikra Chadeh. By the way, is it helpful if I share the document so that people can look at the whole document and they can, you know, why don't I, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put this document in the chat. That way, if you want to open it up in a separate browser, we'll be able to do that. Stop sharing for a second. Chat. Okay, there it is. If anybody wants to look at it in a separate browser so that you can see the whole document, you don't have to be under my thumb for where we are in Hebrew and English. Okay, so the Gemara says, Amar Shmuel, Ka Yoshe Betanis Nikrachote. Shmuel says, anybody who sits in fast is called a sinner. As it says, he holds like Rav Lezer HaKfar, who said, it says, V'chiper alav me'asher chata al ha-nefesh, that the Nazir has to atone for that which he sinned against the soul. Who did he sin against? The Gemara says that he forbade himself wine, and that is a sin. Isn't it a kal v'chomer? One who only forbid themselves from wine is called a sinner. If you forbid other things from yourself, how much more so are you considered a sinner? This is a very clear articulation that seems to be anti-asceticism. Seems to be that you shouldn't, what the Torah forbids of you is forbidden. Shouldn't forbid things on yourself, but are not forbidden by the Torah. Then, of course, we have the opposite opinion. Rav Elazar Omer, Nikra Kadosh. No, in fact, the Nazir is not called a sinner. He's called holy, as it says, Kadoshia Gadol Parer Sarosho. He's holy because he lets his hair grow. That was considered a sign of asceticism. Still is actually in the East. Just like one person who forbids one thing from himself is called holy. Somebody forbids everything upon themselves. Hard to believe it's everything, but how much more so are they considered holy? So that's very interesting. You know, perhaps it is the case that we have more than one tradition in Judaism. You know, we don't always think about that. Maybe we really have more than one valid tradition, even about these meta questions, like asceticism. The Rambam, of course, we know, says that a person should be on the middle path for most things, perhaps everything. And the Rambam sort of makes it a little bit confusing. He says that you're a chacham if you're on the middle path, and you're not too stingy, not too giving. But he does say if you go to an extreme in certain instances, you're called a chassid. The question of whether the Rambam approves of being a chassid or not is a fascinating question. It's open for a lot of interpretation. You find the opposite in other Gemaras. Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rav that this is talking about Shnei Goyim Bevidnech, that there were two nations in Rivka's womb. The Gemara says, don't read them nations, read them geyim, important people. That is Rebbe and Antoninus. Obviously, Rebbe was a Jew, Antoninus was a Greek. And they were equally, you know, aristocratic. There was never anything lacking from their table. And then you have a different Gemara that says when Rebbe, same Rebbe, was on his deathbed, he held up his 10 fingers and said, Master of the universe, you know that I engaged with all my 10 fingers and didn't play treasure from the world, even with my pinky. So I had to resolve these, because especially they said about Rebbe, be it Anasi, the same person, was he an ascetic, as the Gemara in Ketubot seems to say, or was he, you know, or did he have everything on his table? as Gemara and Brachot seems to say. So not only do we perhaps have two traditions, we might even have either some conflation of the two traditions or perhaps some way of bringing both of them together, or maybe Rebbe changed his mind. It seems like if he changed his mind, we certainly know which one was later. That was the one in his deathbed was later. So I'm not sure. I think often I have a theory that the Gemara, when it wants to express complex topics, especially theological ones, it tends to give us opposite opinions, opposite extremes. And what the Gemara is trying to communicate is that there isn't one easy solution, and that often these questions are much better thought of not as single answers, but as dialectical questions. And so for ourselves, we may wonder, what is Judaism's opinion? Here's a beautiful Mesos Sharm. It says, Kol mi shetzarech litol ve'inu notel, anybody who needs to take something from the world and doesn't take, or is a shofech damim, it's as if they are spilling blood, as it says, the nefesh chaya, that a human being has to be, a human being was created by God, nefesh chaya, a living soul, you have to live. Neshama shenetati ba achayata, keep your soul living. And here, so Sharm quotes the Gemara we just read, that anybody who sits in fasting is called a sinner. Below, Matzim Tzar Nafshe, the Hillel Omer, Gomel Nafsho Ish Chesed, Al Chilas Haboker, Vahaya Roche, Tzpan of Yadav, Lechavit Kona. The Gemara says that Hillel used to leave the Beit Midrash and he would go and wash his body and he would eat. And they said, how could you go do that? And he said, he said, if you see the statues of the kings, people are honored to wash the statues of the kings. He said, so to me, I carry around the statue of the king. I'm made in the image of God. And Hillel seemed to believe even the physical body is an image of God. And so that has to be taken care of. This is the true rule. Here's how he solves the problem. Anything that you don't need from this world, Roy Lo Shiafresh Mayhem, says it's fitting to separate yourself from it. If it's a want and not a need, you should separate yourself from it. Anything that you need, may is a tam shia, for whatever reason, he says. That's interesting, so it leaves the door open. Since it's needed by you, Muparish Menor is a chote. So then if you don't take what you need from the world, you're considered a sinner. This is a very interesting pshara, very interesting middle path, where for whatever reason, if you need it, then you should have it. Not only that, it's important, it's mitzvah. And if you don't take it, then you're a sinner. Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, who was quite known for asceticism, actually. They say about Rabbi Nachman that for a while when he was younger, he chewed his food with his middle teeth, with his big teeth, so that he wouldn't taste his food. That's where taste is further back in the mouth. There's certainly many, many places where Rabbi Nachman seems to speak about being ascetic, but there's another side to Rabbi Nachman. He's extremely complex, and he also understood that simcha, that joy, is one of the most important things in Judaism. And he writes a great deal about how to avoid what he calls marash chora, depression. He thought that was really something that can take its toll. Menachem has famous meditation in which he thinks if you focus in on something you've done good and you feel good about yourself and you actually see yourself as having done a mitzvah perfectly, even though you didn't do it perfectly, you should pretend that you did in your own mind. Rabbi Nachman says that will bring you closer to God and will give you the desire to praise God, says this in his famous Torah, Resh Pei Beis. So here he writes, and this is in Sichas Maran, Kvar Mavur B'Lakuta Tanina, in the first part of Lakuta Maran, we already wrote, so these are things that Rabbi Nachman said, it was written down by Rabbi Nassim. Hizr Ma'od, Levli L'Hachimir Chumas Yiseros B'Shem Darvi, you shouldn't have too many chumras. Let's quote from the Gemara. Torah was not given to the malachim, to the angels. He says, just choose one mitzvah, and in that mitzvah, you'll be very careful, and you'll do all the chumras. For me, it's drinking on Purim. You see that there were rabbis of the Gemara also that did that. Gambosa mitzvah al yachanes b'chumos shigayon mishtus marshchoros. He says, but you could become obsessive and you could become depressed and crazy and feel like you're not really keeping it the way you should. If even in that mitzvah, he says, don't go too crazy. You don't want to become obsessive. Do all the chumras in that one mitzvah, but don't do it with insanity. It's a shocking thing. He says, in all the other mitzvahs, is not necessarily to be machmir at all. Well, this is like this year when Pesach came and the rabbis all said to their congregants, things are permitted that have never been permitted before. And see what will happen in the future. It's going to change, I think, the whole nature of halacha and how the lady sees halacha. It says, just do the mitzvahs. Don't have any chumas. Pesach. He says, even Pesach, which by the way, Ashkenazim have an incredible amount of chumas on Pesach. That's why what we did this year, what we permitted for people really was chumar the Pesach. It was things that usually we're very machmir about. Shulchan Aruch is not necessarily machmir about, but the Ramah is much, much more than Shulchan Aruch. And he says, even Pesach, liyam askim klal alamarim ledakli yosem midai. He says, the Rebbe does not agree at all with those who felt it should be very, very machmir about Pesach. V'omar, this is interesting. And the Rebbe said about himself, that he engaged in this, he engaged in asceticism and in chumras. He did it a lot. But it brought him to depression. And now he changed his way. And he changed his mind, saying that Rabbi Nachman changed his mind. And even though when he was younger, he felt that asceticism was important and the chumras and seiros were important, extra strictures, as he got older, he realized that was a bad idea and it gives a person a relationship to Judaism that is negative, that is sometimes depressive, sometimes obsessive, and rather that Judaism has to be integrated into one's normal life. Sort of the opposite of the Ramban. The Ramban is saying, the permissiveness will make it such that you're not living a normal life. Rabbi Nachman saying the strictures can make it such that you're not living a normal life. There's a sense of normality in both the Ramban and in Rabbi Nachman here. The Rebbe talked a lot about this. You should increase Torah and prayer and good deeds. Don't invent any new chumras. Do like they used to do our ancestors in the old days. So that is sort of a bit of an overview of the question of asceticism in Judaism. What is to be gained or lost from leading an ascetic life? I mean, the truth is that spiritually asceticism can be very productive. We know that from Eastern religions. We know it from our own religions. There are great dangers in the pleasures of the flesh that Judaism permits, because sometimes we can feel like everything is permitted. We as Jews, certainly Orthodox Jews, live at a time where I'm sure 100 years ago, nobody would have ever in a million years imagined that we could have what we have. There isn't food that's made that you can't get, the best of as an Orthodox Jew. I mean, it's sometimes shocking, right? Rabbis give mussar about this all the time. But I want to move from the question of asceticism to a bit of a different take on limitation and desire. And there's a famous psychoanalyst, Jacques Lacan, who was a French analyst. And he's a very deep thinker. He had a general sense about the development of the human being. It's important to understand this in order to understand Lacan, that when we're born, we know nothing. We are just a sort of tabula rasa, and we really are our mothers. Even after we're born, we don't know anything as a separate individual. We, on some level, the infant really is their mother, and they don't really have a sense of the world outside of their mother or outside of their own being. The world is sort of unarticulated. Then there's a second stage. So that he calls actually the real world. He then has a second stage called the ideal world. And that is, it begins the first time that a child looks in the mirror and realizes that they are a separate human being from their mother. And at that point, there's this desire that's created to re-merge with the mother, but the child doesn't really have the ability to go out into the world and to make their desires known, to get the things they want to get, because they don't yet have language. It's with the development of language that the child leaves the ideal world and enters the symbolic world. And in the upside of the symbolic world is that now you can be a regular human being. You can speak, you can articulate things, you can talk about your desires, and you can use language and intellect to go in the world to go and find your desires. The downside of it is that something's always missing. That initial stage that you had way back, you're always trying on some level, there's always something missing, something lost. Perhaps it is that you were your mother. All of us were our mothers, whether it's a strange thing that both men and women both used to be at some level women, they were their mothers. You become then separated from that. That's in some psychoanalysts see that as a kind of crisis of the birth is a kind of crisis for the human being. It's very interesting, by the way, in the Chumash, you see that that there was a celebration of being able to eat solid food, being freed from the mother. And in the Gemara says a bizarre thing. Gemara says, you learn the ability to speak comes at the same time that you're able to eat bread. When you get to eat solid food and become separate from your mother, the Gemara says that's when you learn to speak. So it seems to have a similar notion. So Lacan deals a lot with the question of desire, and he feels that just like, you know, Freud thought that that certain things are what motivates us, certain sexual things motivate us. The existentialists felt that the fear of death motivates us in life. So Lacan felt that what motivates our lives, what drives us in the universe, is desire. But it's not a desire for an object that can ever be fulfilled. It's a desire that can actually never be fulfilled, because if it was fulfilled, then the desire is gone and nothing can come of it. But what helps us to function in the world, what helps us to be, to use language to develop the world, is all about this sort of inner desire. And it has a lot to do with those early stages that I described before. So I want to go back to this Rashi of Prushim and Arayotim in Aveira. Why does Rashi single out Arayot, forbidden sexuality? I mean, he could have said food. He could have just said sin. If you separate yourself from all sin, then even though the Ramban doesn't think that's going to make you holy, Rashi seems to think that will make you holy. So why does he pick out of everything in Judaism, separate yourself from arayot, from sexual immorality? Sexual desire is, of course, the mother of all desire, really. So I want to introduce this notion of Lacan, perhaps as a way of understanding what Rashi's getting at, that sexuality is really, on some level, the central motivating factor. Freud felt that way about human beings. But more than that, it is the separation from sexuality that creates the sense of, in other words, it's not, let's see, I wrote down how I wanted to articulate this. In a certain sense, right, Rashi says you find kiddusha when you put a getter around arayot, when you separate yourself from desire. So we'll see in Lacan a similar idea. It is the unfulfilled desire. It is the fence. In other words, what Rashi means is not that we should have no desire. That's not what Rashi says. He says put a fence around desire. What does it mean to have a fence around arayot? It means that I want it, but I can't get to it because there's a fence around it. It's if you got rid of the desire for desire, so then you'd be in trouble. The Gemara says that the rabbis of the Talmud slaughtered the desire for avodah zarah, and that's why we don't have it. And then they slaughtered the desire for sexuality, but then they had to put it back because nothing was created. Nothing was happening. The world came to a standstill. So there has to be, Rashi doesn't say get rid of the desire. He says, in a certain sense, what Rashi I think is saying is retain the desire, saying don't give into it. Because if you give into it, the desire is gone. But it's precisely by putting a getter around our, putting a fence around the desires, that we actually retain desire. And we'll see, for Lacan, the desire is always there. The desire always needs to be retained, because that's what moves us in the world. He says, let's see, I explained a little bit of this. As I mentioned, the first stage is the stage of being unified with the mother. The second stage is realizing you're separate. The third stage is gaining language. How do you gain language? So Lacan felt what he called the name of he made a pun, the nom de père, the know of the father, which is linked to, which could also mean the name of the father. Obviously, it's a Christian reference, but he felt that there's somebody else that steps in between. It's a little bit Freudian, but steps in between the child and the mother, and creates this separation. It's the father, and the father says, "No, you can't be just merged with the mother. You have to go out into the world. There are laws. There are limits. You are a separate being, and there's a way of being in the world." And what those structure and limits that fling us out into the world, it flings us out into this symbolic world to live their meaningful lives of desire and of searching and creating. It's creativity that can really emerge out of this, because just like language is creative, helps us to manipulate other things in the universe, so too this sense of law, of the no, of that which is limited, throws us out into a world, and if we both retain the desire, but we have to use our creativity, our humanness, our language, our articulation to be able to sort of pursue the desire, the grand desire, and that's what makes us who we are as human beings. This transforms the demand of the other into desire for something deeper, a journey embarked upon. Law and limitation thwarts, but it also cultivates. Lacan believes, this is just what I wrote down, believes that this emerges from the limits placed on arayot and uniting with the mother that one came from. The father, as the representative of law out there in the world, stops the child. This produces new relationships and new language. This is how he works in Freud's castration notion. This is only possible when desire is not fully fulfilled, which for Lacan it never really is. And so I thought it's fascinating that right after the pasuk of Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokeichem, what does the Torah say? It says, Daber al b'nei Yisrael, Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Ishi Mova Vivti Rov, Eshab Sayt Shema Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Starts all of a sudden to talk about the mother and father. And we know, as the Mefarshim points out, it's very strange. It says, Ishi Mova Vivti Rov. It seems backwards, because in the Torah elsewhere, it says, V'ahavto, it says, you shall honor your father and mother. But here it says, when it comes to fear, fear your mother and your father. And the Gemara says that's because it's more intuitive to fear your father. The Torah wants to mix it up, because it wants to have equal fear and honor for both the mother and father. But it's interesting to me that when we're talking about Kedusha, about limits on Arayot, that all of a sudden it talks about fearing your mother. And there seems perhaps to be... you know, it's not that Lacan knew Rashi or Rashi knew Lacan or either of them knew Kabbalah. It's that there are certain fundamental deep ideas embedded in the universe, and everybody taps into them in different ways. And I think perhaps there's a mutual tapping in from completely different directions that's being hinted at here in the Torah. And this notion perhaps of the productive desire that emerges. It's interesting that Shabbos is right after that. Why? Because, right, what is Shabbos? Shabbos is about stopping creativity, stopping the manipulation of the world. But of course, it's all in the service of creativity. It's all in the service of having a better articulated world, better control on the world, not just giving into our desires, but rather figuring out how to use the world for something productive. I'll finish with an interesting Sfarno, who also is bothered by what is Kedusha. So again, we've gone from the basic question of is Kedusha asceticism or not? Perhaps Kedusha comes from the inner power of Arayot, from the inner power of desire that gets sort of moved into another direction. The Svarna says Kedusha actually works in a few different ways. He says Kedusha, he says right here in the parasha, when it talks about being holy, it talks about three things, he says. Geter Arayot, it talks about forbidden sexuality. It talks about food. Ashaniti, let's see, are we shown? The third one. Shlishis Atuma B'machal Rasurot. So it talks about forbidden things that you can eat. So not eating things that are forbidden, not having forbidden sexuality. It says the third thing, which he says actually the first thing, is Ov and Yedoni, not getting involved in sorcery. That will bring you Kedusha. So that's interesting, because I understand, you know, limitations on food, limitations on sexuality, it fits right into the Ramban. But, you know, the Ov and Yedoni, not worshiping something, not worshiping, it's not even idols here. Here it's sorcery or divination. The Gemara says these were a way of using skulls to tell the future, or bones. And that the Ramban says, is one of the things that cultivates Kedusha. Why is that? So the Rambam in the Laws of Mezuzah says a well-known thing. He says, some people want to write in their mezuzahs the names of angels, almost like a kameo, like an amulet, or holy names of God, or psukim. They want to add to things that are in the mezuzah. He says, people who do that have no share in the world to come. He says they're taking a mitzvah like mezuzah, whose sole purpose is to link us to God. The whole point of being holy is to be like God. The mezuzah, says the Rambam, is to know that there's one God, so you can connect to God. And what have they done? They have made the mezuzah like an amulet to protect their houses, they imagine it is. Rambam says, if you think the purpose of mezuzah is to protect your house, you have no share in the world to come. That's pretty strong. Kmosha ola libam askel shezet davar aminig b'havle olam. It says that, in other words, when we put faith in superstition, in the over, the yidoni, or even in a mitzvah, if we say the mitzvahs are there to protect us, so that's just selfishness. That's just superstition. It has nothing to do with mitzvahs. Mitzvahs are there to create a connection to God, and to and that we should serve God. And so the Sfarna says, when you replace God with superstition, or you replace God with other things, you are then violating the notion of Kedusha. Kedusha comes when you put aside those other things that you might want to have trust in. And instead of having trust in God, I'll just end with a beautiful Nesiv Shalom, the son Merabi, who he writes that how do you get Kedusha? So he says that we have to be holy. He says the whole point of the reason this is read at Hakel, that the whole point of the Torah is for us to cleave to God. And in order to cleave to God, to have Dveikut with God, we have to be like God. When you become like something else, means you want to connect to it. And he says that's the purpose of being holy. Then he says, why do we say this at Hakel? He says, I'm in the second column here. He says, because being holy is impossible, the Slonimer says. He says, you can try to be holy, but you can't will yourself to be holy. So what do? You have to work on it, and then God will give it to you as a gift. He says, but if you want to get holiness as a gift, it only comes when you're connected to the community. Kedusha inyan shel matana, v'hayachid ena roi lamatana. Says the individual is not fitting to get a gift. It's only when the whole Jewish people are together, when you're together with the community, then you're fitting to get the gift of Kedusha. And he continues, and he says that, that's why Shabbos comes right after Kedoshin Tiyu, Kiyoshin Yishan, Ishimov of Torah, Shabbos, Sosai Tishmoru. Tishma, because says Shabbos also can only be Shabbos also is a gift, as the Gemara says. God said, "I have a matana yeshli ves genuzi. I have a gift in my storehouse, and it's called Shabbos." And he says, "So too Shabbos, just like the individual cannot get the gift of kedusha on their own, so too Shabbos it takes having a community You have to have the Rabbim, you have to have the community in order to have Shabbos. It resonates, I think, with us because we are trying very hard to have Shabbos on our own, and it's not so easy. My hope is that that very soon we can all be back with our communities in person, and both Kedusha, holiness, as the Sfarno says, and Shabbos, as the Sfarnomer says, the Sfarnomer says Kedusha and Shabbos. We can both acquire through reconnecting with our communities and with other Jews, hopefully in person, in the Holy Land in Erevin. Amen. Happy to have questions.
All right. Comments. Thank you very much. If anybody has any questions, orally or by chat, but thank you for introducing me to some sources that I am very unfamiliar with. Some I am quite familiar with, and some very unfamiliar with. So
Lacan is very hard to read, together. But I love it. Yeah. Yes, How can a nazir fill the mitzvah of drinking 4 cups of wine at the Passover Seder? Oh, that's a good question. It's a very good question. Does a nazir have to undo his vow in order to fulfill the mitzvah, or? This is the kind of question that's probably in black and white and has been discussed a great deal. But, or do we say that Asi Dochlosa, say the positive commandment of keeping a vow would push aside the 4 cups, which are the Rabbanan? Or should we tell him to use, maybe like Rav Chaim Brisker said to the poor, that story of the poor man who came to Rav Chaim Brisker and he said, can I drink milk for the 4 cups of wine? And Rav Chaim Brisker said, I'm going to give you money to buy wine. But he gave him much, much more money than he would have needed to buy wine. So the Rebbetzin said to him, he asked you, he needed wine. Why'd you give him so much money? He said, if he was asking me if he can drink milk for the 4 cups, obviously he doesn't have meat for the Seder. So I gave him money for wine. And so maybe he could drink 4 cups of milk. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Great to meet everybody. And I wish everyone.